It's great to be with all of you today. I'm sitting here because I'm just so weary from having the flu. I've been in hundreds of conferences in my lifetime, but never spent 95% of the time in the hotel room. And so I'm just hoping I can go through this without a meltdown. If I do start to have a meltdown, just turn away, okay? And just act embarrassed and turn away, and I'll recover, and we'll go on. I even forgot my reading glasses, so I borrowed somebody's reading glasses. They may be John Hodges, I don't know, but whoever belongs to these glasses, please grab me. Okay, because they're not the right prescription for me. John's shaking his head. Okay, they're not it. So whoever gave them to me, catch me afterwards. Okay, but they're better than nothing. So let's go, because I know we want to end on time. I know you want to get going. I see this guy's wearing a mask here because of my cold. So I do. Okay. So the title of my talk is Responding to the Inevitable Unraveling of Higher Education. John Kopperman said, for the first time in the history of our country, the educational skills of one generation will not surpass, will not equal, will not even approach those of their parents. When I first heard Francis Schaeffer, I was with a group of six guys, and somebody had one cassette of Schaeffer's. And we were sitting in a circle, and he played this cassette, which is on the Lord's work and the Lord's way, or Give Us Tongues of Fire. And when that cassette was over, we just all sat there like, what did we just hear? We just were totally stunned. In that talk, Schaeffer talks about that we live in a post-Christian world, in a post-Christian country. And that had never crossed any of our minds before. We had never thought of it, and we most certainly had never thought of the implications of that. And so here we are, 40 years later, and the implications are now everywhere to be seen. And what we are witnessing is the secularization of culture at every single point. So in the book Escape from Reason, Schaeffer talks about the division between grace and nature. And grace is just the things that give you meaning, the things that give you purpose, issues about the eternal, the permanent. And nature is just the physical part of the universe. And what Schaeffer argues for in the Escape from Reason is that once grace is not rooted in reality, nature, he says, eats up grace. And that's what we've seen in our world. Is that, and that's my way of putting it, is the secularization of culture at every single point. So even in many departments of religion and even in theological schools and seminaries, the question of God is irrelevant to how people live their lives, how they think about their studies, how they even think about their religious organizations. That's the secularization of culture. The question for us today and for this whole conference is, what is the effect on culture? What is the effect on education? How has that affected education? Now, my comments are, for the most part, going to be on higher education, college, and graduate programs. But I'll say a little about lower education. And I take that that the purpose of lower education is to learn how to think. And the four R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and reality. And the problem is, once the fourth R drops out, everything is free-floating. Except for a few notable exceptions. Homeschooling, the Waldorf schools, lower education is now worse than ever before. Lower scores, inability to think at all. The great Hoover Institution scholar at Stanford, Thomas Sowell, said, the problem is not merely that Johnny can't read or that Johnny can't think. Johnny doesn't know what thinking is because thinking is so often confused with feeling in many public schools. So this just sets an increasingly dismal context for higher education. Colleges are simply spinning out of control on so many fronts. Take the cost. We right now have $1.75 trillion in student loan debt, increasing by tens of millions of dollars every hour. Before forbearance, due to COVID, approximately 40% of students who had loans had never made a payment. It's been said there are only two sources that will give a 17-year-old a $200,000 loan. A loan shark and the U.S. government. So a 17-year-old has no job, no credit history, no assets. Of course, there are taxes. I pay taxes. You pay taxes. $148 billion of our taxes goes to higher education every year. Who doesn't pay taxes? Colleges and universities don't pay taxes. And you may say, well, yes, but I mean, football games and concerts on campus that have nothing to do with the education, they pay taxes, don't they? No, they pay no taxes. When you watch a football game on ABC or NBC or CBS, that's all tax-free income for them. So no taxes on property, tuition, government funding in the way of subsidies and grants, no taxes on donations, no taxes on capital gains or on their investment. Colleges have these things called endowments. Endowments are their stockpile of money. 13 colleges now have endowments of more than $20 billion. Harvard's endowment is $53 billion. $53 billion in cash. How much cash does McDonald's have? With, I don't know, 50,000 restaurants around the world, $2.3 million. What about Starbucks? $3 billion. Facebook comes up to Harvard at $53 billion. But Facebook has billions of users. If we think about inflation, from 1980 to today, inflation has gone up 217%. College cost has gone up 1,200% in the same time. And this is not an exaggeration. For many students, possibly most, college is little more than a 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 year party. I've taught in colleges where basically nothing is required. And if you fail somebody, you almost certainly are going to be standing in the dean's office. And that's not to hear from the dean how good you're doing. You've got to give a justification for why you failed a student, because it's all about enrollment. And enrollment is all about the money. So college being a party has almost nothing to do with becoming an independent, responsible thinker. What most colleges are today in America is retirement villages for the young. And colleges are pandering in the most shameless way to students. And I could have chosen dozens of examples, but I'll give you two examples. Here's Texas Tech, and this is in their literature. The Ewald Student Recreation Center enjoys a reputation for being one of the largest facilities of its kind in the country. It takes up 250,000 square feet to accommodate 8 multipurpose courts, 2 cardiovascular areas with 120 pieces of equipment, and the usual college campus games and activities. The student leisure pool also enjoys, and I love this wording, I mean, this is so amazing. The student leisure pool also enjoys a superlative existence. A superlative existence as the largest one in the nation. Its lazy river is 645 feet long. So that's a powered river. Okay. And is the center of the pool's design. It eventually costs a total of $8.4 million. The indoor pool facility is completely enclosed. This is an interesting one. This was rated number one, by the way, by College Rank. The sports center is a two-story complex that also has the standard amenities that most every other college has, except it also has a 12-lane bowling alley, ice skating rink, a miniature golf course, an indoor water park, and a simulated surfing with a multi-million dollar wave rider, flow rider. Now that's pulling out all the stops. And this is the perfect line right here. And the tuition does not reflect all that you get as a student. And you're thinking, I don't know if this was written by the accounting department, but someone's paying for this thing, and I have a strong intuition it's the students who are paying for it. But no, it costs you nothing. And now here's the school. By far, Pensacola Christian College has the best aquatic and recreational experience to offer college students. So there you go. There's the heart of the Christian college. What about outcomes? In the landmark book, Academically Adrift, the authors used a state-of-the-art collegiate learning standardized test following 2,300 students through 2,400 academic institutions for their entire college career. What they found is that 45% of college students improve in absolutely nothing. There was no improvement in thinking, reading, writing, any kind of analysis. No improvement whatsoever. It's interesting, when it was reported by a young woman who was a new graduate, she reported that 45% had no improvement, and she said, and that's a majority. Because of this, I mean, and this outcome, by the way, is not a mystery. This is just not a mystery. Everyone who's in the teaching profession knows the tide has gone out long ago. The last class I taught at the last college, I taught a class, philosophy through film. I'm a philosopher. And I said to students, I'm going to show you films you've never seen before. Nothing blows up. Nothing's computer generated. And actually, people talk to each other. Start showing them films. Student came to me a couple weeks later. He said, you know, I'm having a very hard time understanding the movies that are in black and white. I'm just totally dumbstruck. And I said, well, they're in English. Remembering my prior thought of, you know, maybe I should have some, you know, foreign language films that are dubbed. And I thought, oh, that's probably too much for them. And I said, well, they're in English. He said, yes, but they're not in color. Now, I thought that's as bad as it gets. And here's a little freebie piece of wisdom, if you want, out of these talks. Whenever you have that thought, you're always wrong. Okay, if you have the thought, this is as bad as it gets, things can get worse. A couple weeks later, a female student came to me and said, you know, all these movies are just too long. 90 minutes, 2 hours. What we need is 5-minute movies. Now, if someone is not capable of watching a 90-minute movie, what do you think the chances are that they are going to read a book? Yeah, exactly 0.0% chance that they would read a book. And I met many students who told me, and they're 4 or 5 years of college, they never read a book. Never read a book. And most of them, when they wrote papers, all they do is Google the topic, go in 10 or 20 pages, dig up some obscure thing, cut and paste, change words that they don't understand. And that's it. Paper done. Write on anything. You know, nuclear power plants in China. Have it to you in an hour. Yeah. Photosynthesis of bamboo leaves. I'll have that to you in an hour. Doesn't matter. No thinking, no reading, no comprehension. So you see, when I was a teacher in colleges, and I suspected, which I often did, plagiarism, I would just ask the student, hey, could you come into my office? I had a couple questions. Hey, I had trouble understanding your paper. Could you just explain to me what it's about? And then there was just, you know, the total, you know, nuclear meltdown. Accompanied with tears and all the rest. But this is why now these top 10 companies no longer require a 4-year degree. Google, Apple, IBM, Starbucks, Bank of America, Tesla, Netflix, Chipotle, Penguin Random House, and Costco. You don't have to have a 4-year degree to start working for them. You see, well, I'll get to this later. I tend to jump ahead on my thoughts, okay. And then you have the COVID shift. The COVID shift was when COVID came, of course, everyone went online. And the enterprising students at Harvard said to Harvard, well, since we're no longer paying for in-class instruction, we want some of our money back. And Harvard said no, because of the prestige of the name. But you see, COVID now has changed the whole thing. I'm restoring a house, and it's been a long, long project. And people who I don't see every day always ask, is that house done yet? You know. But I always am looking on YouTube to find out how to do things. Okay, so now on YouTube you can look up almost anything. And a lot of people, and I'll just add this in, we'll get to it, mistakenly think that YouTube is a substitution for education. But you see, that's part of the COVID switch. What all this raises is the question, what is the purpose of college? And I'll just throw out my first jab at it, to actively explore the most detailed scholarly work of various academic fields and to participate in the ongoing discussion of the truth as it is revealed. It is to start to become a scholar. And it's important to say this does not interest everyone. I do not believe everyone should go to college. Some of my very dearest friends, some of the wisest people I know, never went to college. But you see, part of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, is this idea everybody should go to college. And so when you have a majority of people in college who have absolutely no interest in what's being taught, it's an utter waste of time and money. And it's money that they're going to have to be paying back for a long, long time. I had students all the time who had $150,000 of college debt and were not done with their undergraduate degree yet. And I said, well, you know, you've got a mortgage now. The only problem is you lost the house part of it. You don't have a house. And they have absolutely no idea how this is going to change their lives in an utterly profound way. I don't believe everyone should go to college. And you see, what's happened in college now is that college is the new high school. You didn't learn how to read and you didn't learn how to write. My last semester, I had two students who could not write an English sentence. And I had one of them come into my office and I said, how did you get into this college? You can't write a sentence. These are just random words on his exam. And he said, well, I wasn't expecting an essay exam. I said, it was announced the first day of class, you know. Well, all my other exams have been true, false. And this is a college that's famous for being academically rigorous. And so I said, how'd you get into this college? And he looked at me kind of puzzled and he said, well, you know, I play soccer. He's a soccer player, so let him in. And what happens? The whole level of the college drops across the board now. Students study less, they get higher grades. They do far less work. They are incapable of reading just even standard texts. I mean, one time, just to give you a book that you're all, or many of you are familiar with, I had my students read, or I at least assigned it, that's what I should say. I assigned them to read C.S. Lewis's book, Abolition of Man. Most were utterly incapable of reading the book. They go, I can't understand it. I said, well, what part? Oh, the whole thing. Well, how about the first sentence? How'd you do on that? Ah, impossible. Can't understand. So not everybody should go to college, and this is most, and we really have to emphasize this, I believe, this is not a measure of a person's worth. One of the greatest intellects who ever lived in the history of the world never went to college. Abraham Lincoln was self-educated on three books. King James Bible, you all got that one, right? The King James Bible, the works of Shakespeare, and Euclid's Elements, basic geometry about reasoning. And then what do you have? One of the most articulate and insightful people who ever lived. And what do we have today? Zillions of books, and everybody's got to have, you know, their computer in order to go to college, and they end up learning nothing. When I taught, and it's just been a couple years since I just couldn't take it anymore, and I put in for parole and got parole. You know? I mean, I had a rule, you could not use a cell phone in the class, you could not use a computer in the class, because I want you to actually talk with other people. They went to the dean to complain. And then I was once again called into the dean's office. And again, that's not to congratulate you. He said, can't you just be a little bit accommodating? He said, they're on their cell phones the entire class. This is the same dean, by the way, who told me when I first interviewed and got the job, he said, now you must never tell a student they're wrong. You know, and I'm totally, like, baffled. I said, is that the way you teach mathematics here? Because if it is, it's impossible to learn math. Somebody doesn't tell you way down the line, 2 + 3 does not equal 6. I mean, you're just crippled for a lifetime. These crazy ideas. Now, of course, you try to tell people the wrong gently, the way you would want to be told you're wrong. You don't try to make them look like a fool. But we all need to be corrected. We all need to be. And, you know, faithful are the wounds of a friend. I mean, when I taught, I every day before I went to school, I prayed for my students. Because I believed that that classroom was really about their whole life being able to discover, being able to recognize the truth of God. I didn't take it as a light matter. I took it as seriously as any brain surgeon takes his or her surgery. I believe that their eternal soul was on the line. But you see, college has just changed in such radical ways. I mean, that all the contemporary literature on college is bleak. There is no agreement on the purpose of college, and there is no agreement on the solutions. But there is complete agreement that the entire system is seriously broken. And here, you can just hear it in some of these titles. Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters by Michael Roth. Education's End, Why Colleges and Universities Have Given Up on the Meaning of Life, Andrew Kornman. Our Underachieving Colleges, A Candid Look at How Much Students Learn and Why They Should Be Learning More by Derek Bach, former president of Harvard. Tenured Radicals, How Politics Has Corrupted Our Highest Education by Roger Kimball. Higher Education, How Colleges Are Wasting Our Money and Failing Our Kids and What We Can Do About It by Hacker and Dreyfus. College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Reforming Our Universities by David Horowitz. Save the World on Your Own Time by Stanley Fish. Nice title, huh? Crisis on Campus by Mark Taylor. Here are some of the various solutions that are offered. End tenure, restore mandatory retirement, reduce presidential salaries, get rid of departments, make students use their minds. Yes, and when I read that, I thought, oh, good, I want to see how you do that. Yeah, no idea. Cultivate the heart and the mind, same thing. Encourage reflection and self-scrutiny. Mark Taylor actually thinks from Crisis on Campus that the President of the United States should give, quote, the highest national priority to a national teaching academy housed in Chicago and presided over, I presume, by Mark Taylor. So. Now, what's interesting is I can name colleges that are doing all of those things and failing horribly. Clearly, they sound a little bit inadequate to change the course of colleges. All of these solutions sound superficial and therefore all sound utterly inadequate to begin to address the problems in higher education. The one exception is Alan Bloom's famous book from 1987, The Closing of the American Mind, How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and impoverished the souls of today's students. When The Closing of the American Mind was first published, it dropped like a bomb in the media because Bloom was really one of the first ones that said that higher education is in a disastrous state. And people just said, how is this possible? This is the United States of America, for heaven's sakes. And yet, over the last 30 years, people have become convinced he was right. Something is desperately wrong. It was meted both with praise and condemnation. Conservatives hailed it as a vindication of their long-endured criticisms about American culture in general, and higher education in particular. Liberals denounced it as elitist and intolerant, and they said Bloom wanted to keep students ignorant of other cultures so he could indoctrinate them and run liberal professors out of the colleges. Of course, neither side had it right. Bloom's book didn't hide its purpose and didn't hide its position. It's right there in the preface. Think they'd be able to see it. right in the preface. It's a meditation on the state of our souls. And you can see, well, I could see where that would cause people a little bit uncomfort. Okay. The state of your soul. Bloom believed that Plato's cave was culture. What is Plato's cave? Plato's cave is a very famous story as conveyed through Socrates in the writings of Plato. And it's about a man who climbs down into a dark cave and he comes into a whole nother world. I'm sorry, I'm telling it wrong. It's about a man who's in the cave. And he's chained up in this cave. And in front of him is the kind of thing we'd call a screen. It's funny, I mean, it's like Plato figured out what a movie theater would be, you know. 25 centuries before movie theaters. But anyway, man is in this cave. There's a screen in front of him, but he doesn't know it's a screen, and there are all these images. And everyone around him is chained up so that they have to look at the screen. And that's life. And this guy, who ends up to be Socrates, kind of painfully pulls himself out of the chains and the ropes and is able to turn around and see a fire that's being used as a projector to project these images up on the screen. And you see, the problem is all these people, all of humanity is in this cave, and they're completely deluded about what life is about. They think that life is about the things they see, smell, taste, touch, and hear. They think that that life is about sensate experiences. Just like today, right? And they think that there's nothing else to think about in life. And you see, what this person in Plato's cave, what Socrates realizes in this cave, is that the things you see are not important. The things you see are not the most important thing in life. You can't see a person's character. You know, this old thing, there's a zillion songs on it. I saw her from across the room, and I immediately fell in love. And I could tell she was a really good person. Yeah, they always forget to tell you she was very attractive to you also. You can't tell a person's character by what you can see. As Paul says, the most important things are the things you do not see. And that the things you see are not important. The things that are important are eternal. The human soul, the character of a person, God and God's kingdom. Those are the most important things in life. But you see, in the cave, everybody is focused on those idols and images. And so anyway, Bloom wants to have college education be about helping people get outside the cave so that they can ponder the single most important question of human life. What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean? Without this search, students will forever remain in their respective caves. Now, Bloom began the book by saying this, this first sentence. There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes or says he believes that truth is relative. What's that mean? There is no universal truth. All there are is various perspectives. And you never can get beyond your perspective. In my field, there's a philosopher who said, it's a nice way of putting it, you never can escape the circle of ideas. And the ideas are all in your mind. And therefore, you can never escape your mind. So you never can break out to reality. You never can find what's true. Truth, by the way, just to quickly define it, we looked over a little deeper in one of the workshops yesterday. But truth is simply a correspondence between a belief or a sentence and what the belief or sentence is about. Okay. You use this every day, all the time. Right? You driving your car, you look at your gas gauge. Why? Because it's so interesting to look at? No, you couldn't care less. You know, I bought the car because it has such a beautiful gas gauge. Yeah. You remember in high school you used to run out of gas a lot? You probably haven't done that in a long time. Yeah, you look at the gas gauge. Why? Because you want to find out the truth of what's going on in the gas tank. And if you don't find out that truth, we all know what that means. And it's not fun to be hiking down, Highway 52. Looking for some place to get gasoline. So it's just simply when your beliefs match reality, that's called truth. And one of the hardest lessons any of us have to learn in this life is that your beliefs do not make reality. And if you don't learn that lesson, life is incredibly hard. Because life is relentless and it just keeps coming at you and coming at you and coming at you. Dallas Willard used to say, reality is what you hit when you're wrong. Right? So there you are driving your car, and you haven't looked at your beloved gas gauge, for 3 weeks, and it just rolls to a stop. And you go, what is this, And then it kind of dawns on you, look at the gas gauge, and it says E. And now it dawns on you, I'm out of gas. And you just have this belief going, churning along. This car is so great, never have to put gas in it. So to say truth is relative is to say you never can get to the truth. And Bloom in 1987 said, almost every student thinks that. Now those in 87 were the students, they've now become the professors and the administrators. They now run the show. And that's exactly what they still believe. No such thing as truth. Colleges are almost without exception not about truth and knowledge. And most professors on both the scientific side and on the humanities side deny that there are any such things as truth and knowledge. Here's Dallas Willard on this topic. The ideal of an intellectual, artistic, and academic life as the pursuit of truth or just being logical is far beyond being in deep trouble in the university today. And in many places is appropriating the status of a lost cause. Here's Willard again. So today we ask such questions as these. Where do we now stand? What are the issues of life that matter most now? Where on the field of life are the most important battles being fought in which my life can be best expended? What can I do now? What can we do that will be the most beneficial to the good of human beings and the glory of God? And he says, for Christians and for Christian institutions today, there can be only one answer to this question. By far the most important battle being fought the world over is the battle for truth itself. It is the battle over the very nature of knowledge and reality. So we had defined truth. I'll just quickly define knowledge and reality. Knowledge involves truth. So knowledge requires three things. You have to have a belief. The belief must be true, so you can't know what's false. And the belief must be justified. You must have evidence. Knowledge comes in degrees. And you often can get more evidence if you need it. If you ask me, the standard example I use, if you ask me how much money I earned last year, I can throw out a rough number. Now, when the IRS sends you a letter asking you how much money you earned last year, they're not asking for a rough number. They're asking for, right, a cardboard box full of justification. And if you throw out a rough number, you will hear from them again. We can get more justification. But often, we don't require it. You know, there's a fellow sitting right here, I don't know who he is, but suppose he tells me he's from, Albuquerque. Okay, I probably will believe him, you know. Now, I could get more justification, right, by asking to see his driver's license or something like that. So knowledge requires three things. Have to have a belief. The belief has to be true. Belief has to be justified. That's knowledge. What is reality? Reality is just everything that exists. Everything that exists. And so, you know, it's a big question. What are the things that exist? Does God exist? Now, I clearly can think of things that don't exist. I can think of the $1 million in my briefcase here. All right? And here's a thought. It's a true thought. If there were $1 million in my briefcase, I would feel much better than I do. Unfortunately, I can think of... So merely thinking of something doesn't make it real. Shakespeare said, if dreams were horses, then beggars could ride. But if you've ever been around horses, you know very quickly, they're not dreams. I mean, you better bring a shovel because dreams don't leave quite the mess that horses do. Yeah, so merely because I can think of something doesn't make it real. So, So Willard says, it's a battle over the very nature of knowledge of reality. And on this point, they are locked in a battle to the death with the secular approach to truth, knowledge, and therefore education. Compare that to Francis Schaeffer in his very first book, The God Who Is There, 1968. The present chasm between the generations has been brought about by, has been brought about almost entirely by a change in the concept of truth. So this change in the concept of the way we come to knowledge and truth is the most crucial problem, as I understand it, facing Christianity today. 1968, 50 years ago. And what happened? That battle was then lost. And truth and knowledge have disappeared from higher education and the general culture. According to Barna, the major cultural outlook on truth and knowledge today is to the effect that there is no objective truth or reality, and that what we call facts are only human products. Therefore, there's nothing more to knowledge than the best professional practice. Moral principles, more than all else, are taken to be mere prejudices of certain groups, none which are superior to others. According to Barna Research Group, 71% of all adults in the United States say there is no such thing as absolute or objective truth. What that means is that nearly three-fourths of Americans think that truth is a matter of what we or some group believe. Now add that 40% of evangelical Christians also hold that truth and therefore knowledge are relative. Very quickly, here are two examples. One, here's from the scientific side. This is Amber Miller, Dean and Professor of Physics at one of my former schools, USC. As humans, we construct reality through an intricate subconscious balancing act between biological sensory perception and prior knowledge. That balance was impacted over the past few years as many of us, our interactions shifted to virtual modes of socializing and communicating. So we construct reality. You can't get to reality. Reality is a construction. And of course, there are many different constructions. Everybody has their own construction. Now, of course, the question to ask Amber Miller, Amber, is this sentence here a construction, or is this the way it really is? And of course, there's no answer to that, because she is telling you what she thinks is really the case. And for those of you who would appreciate, this is another form of Kantianism from the philosopher Immanuel Kant. Never can get to reality. Here's an evangelical, actually, a dear friend of mine, John Seale, those who believe in absolute truth, or what Francis Schaeffer called true truth, find the admission to the limits of human knowledge hard to swallow. They hear relativism. Well, I mean, of course, there's all kinds of limitations to our knowledge. And you see, part of being responsible with knowledge is that we go back and we check our justification. When things really matter, you check. And the more it matters, the more you check. I remember asking my father as a child, why do you keep looking back down the highway when you're making a turn onto the highway? I was pretty young, and he explained, well, because if there's a car coming at us and I turn in front of it, we're all dead. No, keep looking, man. Here's another very prominent Christian thinker, Jamie Smith, and I'll read several quotations from him. Jamie Smith at Calvin College. However, we need to consider these deep differences in interpretation rather than glibly supposing that the Christian account is objectively true and then castigating the Buddhist account for being merely an interpretation. In fact, both are interpretations. Neither is objectively true. And I think the problem with that is there's no problem with saying Christianity is an interpretation of reality. We, however, think it has the justification so that we are able to say it is the true one. It is the objectively true one. Okay? So just because something is interpretation does not mean that you can't examine it as an interpretation. You see, this allows for that very important philosophical word, mistake. Because we often discover that our interpretation was wrong. And you have to, and then you look back and you see, oh, I was wrong. You know, that often puts us in this very painful situation where we get in an argument with someone and someone we even care deeply for. And, you know, you're arguing away and, you know, let's say, you know, she says to me, you said you'd be here by 4. And I said, no, I didn't. Yes, you did. You said when we were, you know, at the gas station, you'd be here by 4. And then, of course, I remember, oh, my gosh, I did say that. You know, and I've got to then say, you know, you're right. My interpretation of when I should show up was just wrong. That's what it means to be a finite person, you see. But that doesn't eliminate that there is actually objective knowledge. Okay, it does mean you're not God, which should be a welcome thing to all of you because the universe is a big thing to run. Okay. Here's another one. Language is a lens through which we see the world. It's a very common view, you see, of the. This is called postmodernism, you see. This is rejecting objective truth and knowledge. Language is a lens through which we see the world, albeit with some distortion, simply because this lens stands between us and the world. As soon as there is a lens, there is distortion. So you all get it? There's a lens between you and the world, and so you never can see things as they actually are. And so here's the question I would ask Professor Smith if I talked to him. It's almost like the question God asks of Adam in the Bible. Remember, God says to Adam, who told you were naked? Well, I wouldn't say ask Jamie Smith that question, but yeah. I would ask him this question. Who told you there's a lens? Because if there's a lens between you and the world, then how do you ever discover that there's a lens between you and the world? You see, that's like... That's like taking out your eyes so you can look at them. Which is hard. Yeah. Who told you there's a lens? And this is a very common motif. Never can see things as they are. Now notice, when you say there's a lens between you and the world, that's a report on how things really are. Yeah, and see, then again, it's a repeat. If everything is an interpretation, then even the gospel is always an interpretation and not objectively true. But you see, what we don't have is an explanation of why an interpretation cannot be objectively true. That's the question. Of course it's an interpretation. Every time I look at something, I interpret. I'm looking here, there's a cell phone. And I quickly interpret, that's not my cell phone. So we're interpreting all the time. But that doesn't mean that some interpretations are not objectively true. And that doesn't mean that some interpretations cannot have adequate justification. And as I've said, you can get more and more justification when it's really important. And you would think, if you're talking about the destiny of your eternal soul, justification is a pretty important issue. You want to find out what's objectively true. You know, when John Newton wrote the hymn Amazing Grace, he was a former slave ship owner, and he was terribly tormented about the people that he led to death in the greed of slavery. And his search at that point was, what must I do to be reconciled to God? I'm a murderer. And you see, he wanted to find out what is objectively true with respect to his position before God. And that's the basis of the hymn Amazing Grace. Now, I have to very quickly just say a little about this. I'm almost done. We need to say something. So we're talking now about the loss of truth and knowledge in the universities. I'm going to shift a little bit over. It's a little bit of a rough transition, but so be it. And I call it the mental damnation of electronic media. Electronic media has completely taken over the Western world and the universities. So when you have a chance, look this article up, use Google, even though the title is, look up this article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? It's by Nicholas Carr. It was in the Atlantic. Is Google making us stupid? And you all know the answer. Okay? And you see, and it's this was a breakthrough article on this topic. Carr is a scientific researcher. I brought him out to the college I was teaching at to lecture. He said when he was giving the lecture, he could see that the entire students in the balcony, like close to 1,000, were all looking at their cell phones. Why he gave a lecture on, is Google making us stupid? Go figure. This is no small issue. He also wrote a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. So, very quickly, Carr was in a group of friends that would meet for coffee. And somebody one time just said, you know, I'm having a hard time reading books lately. I love to read, but I'm not reading any books. And a couple other people said, you know, me too. I don't think I've read a book all year. And that kind of got Carr interested, and he started looking into it. And what he found is that using the internet more and more and more rewires your brain so that you become basically incapable of reading. I mean, you can read a page or two on the internet, but you can't read much more. And what happens is, that's why Carr calls it the shallows. Shallower, shallower, shallower. And this is something that I find most Christians have not faced. Watching YouTube videos is not the same thing as reading. Here's what Carr says. Here's what Carr says in the shallows. It is the very fact that book reading understimulates the senses that makes the activity so intellectually rewarding. And so I just want to say, this is part of the picture why education is headed straight down the drain. Electronic media has taken over the whole thing. And if you want to love God with all of your heart and your mind and your soul, you have to be able to learn as a discipline before God to lay down the phone, put away the computer, and to take ordinary life as it comes. It's one of the things, I've noticed that, I don't know, hundreds of Dallas Willard lectures are on YouTube. Hundreds and hundreds. And what I have found since those have come on, well, here's what I have not found more than two or three people out of thousands who have read any Dallas Willard. They don't read it anymore. They watch YouTube videos. And that's just another form of television. And the difficulty is that's totally passive. You're just sitting there as a blob. Okay. You know, they make the C.S. Lewis books into movies. What do you think C.S. Lewis would have thought? As a writer who loved the written word, who loved to sit around with friends in a pub and laugh and talk, the interchange between people. So I'm just throwing that out there for you. Look at Carr's work, but think about that, because we will not be leaders in our culture. We will not be able to speak for Christ convincingly in this world until we are able to get back to contemplating the deep truths of God actively, and that will never happen through things like YouTube. Okay, so that's just a little minor point before I come in for a landing. Years and years ago, I said to Jacques, I don't know, is he even in here? I said to Jacques, I'm going to give you a quote from Schaefer you've never heard before. And I'm not even sure where it came from. It may have come from when I was a student at LaBrie, and on Saturday night they had discussion, question and answer time with Schaefer. Okay, and this was the question: How can we prepare to go to university and study when it's so anti-Christian? Okay, now it was anti-Christian in a different way then, because there's existentialism and so forth, which has pretty much died out. But how can we prepare? And Schaefer said, when my children went to university, they had already taken on every big issue that they were going to face at the University of Lausanne. Because we sat around the dinner table and talked about it. And then he said, this is the quotation. He said something, I mean, it was long ago. He said something along the lines, I would not send someone to college who has read nothing but Lorna Doone. And I remember thinking, my gosh, I haven't even read Lorna Doone. I don't even know what it is. You know? I remember having this panic. Oh my gosh, I'm really behind. But you see, it doesn't mean you have to become a Christian philosopher, but it does mean you have to take personal responsibility. You have to set up active ways to learn. I suggest you do it in community. Get a group of friends. I'm in a book reading group through a local ministry here, Tent Makers, and we meet with on Zoom and go through books. You've got to find a way to do that, to get thinking about these issues. I mean, conferences like this are great, but they're only 2 days out of a year. If you do not do it, it will not happen. As Dallas used to say, I could just remember him saying this 1,000 times. Well, Greg, if you fail to plan, just plan on failing. Okay, Dallas, I got it, you know. It's like a father figure, you know, so it's... There is a... Here's a thing Dallas used to say all the time. Greg, when you talk to people about... When I talk to people about learning and becoming a leader and taking learning and knowledge and truth seriously, he said, the hardest thing in the world is for people to take that seriously for themselves. They always say, you know, who, me? Me? That's for someone else. That's for the conference speakers, not for me. And yet every single one of us is called by God to love him with all of our heart, our mind, our strength, and our soul. In the very place that God has placed us. And each of us is in a different place and will touch different people. And that's the call. And Dallas said, you just can't get people to take it seriously. There was this awful song out years ago. I mean, I'll just say God awful. That's how awful it was. By Alice Cooper, which is another bad problem. And you remember this song? School's Out Forever. You remember that? And what's the theme of that song? Hey, we're done with learning. We don't have to learn anymore. And think about what kind of life that is. I'm done learning. You know, they have commencement in universities and everyone has the robe on. But what is commencement? You know, and then they throw their hats in the air. What's commencement mean? For most people, it means that's the end. That is it. But in fact, commencement means the beginning. The beginning. The beginning of lifetime learning. And again, I just have to stress this. Not all of us will specialize in the exact same thing. I mean, there are people here who are experts in their fields that I will never comprehend. But I can learn from them, and maybe they can learn from me. But as a community, we have to do this. We cannot put it off to other people to do. We call ourselves followers of Jesus Christ. And I'll end just with one last point. One of my favorite thinkers is Simone Weil. And she was a French intellectual, raised an atheist. When she was 9 years old, she refused. She identified with suffering people. And when she was 9 years old, she refused to wear socks anymore because the soldiers in the war did not have socks. And this drove her crazy. And when she's 14 years old, she refused to eat sugar anymore because she heard about some peasants who didn't have sugar. And she always identified with suffering people. When she went to college at the Sorbonne in Paris, she, for the very first time, became exposed to the New Testament message about God so loving humanity that he sacrificed everything to redeem humanity. And she became a fervent, and I'll just put in quotations for you, or brackets, often confused, believer, but profound in so many deep ways. In fact, she was moved over to England during the Second World War with the French Free Government to write a book on what does a government need to survive, because hers had collapsed and in France. And she wrote a book called The Need for Roots. But she so identified with suffering people that she starved herself to death because she refused to eat more food than her friends were getting in the concentration camps. We have her diaries. And I mean, it's so profound to read her diaries. And in one of her diaries, near the end of her life, she says, "You could not wish to be born in a better time when all is lost." Do you get it? You could not wish to have been born in a better time when all is lost. This is the very best time to be a Christian. Not because everything's going our way, not because everyone agrees with it, not because there's, you know, achievements and victories at every point. This is the very best time to be alive because all is lost. And you, as a follower of Christ, are needed as never before.